Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. We are a NPR station. We're a news and jazz station, and we have some of the best jazz DJs and talents in town here on the mics. You just heard one for the last 3 hours on the radio, Marcellus Shepard, who is the bass man, is one of the best, and one of the other guys who knows more about jazz, has forgotten more about jazz than most people know, is Doc Manning, who's host of In the Tradition every Monday at 8 o'clock here on WEAA, that I always listen to on my way out of here. Doc, welcome. Good to have you with us, brother. Doc, you there? Oh, we don't have Doc? Let's get him on the phone. We have here with us in the studio is Richard Burgess, who's a producer and project director of Jazz, the Smithsonian Anthology, and he's director of marketing and sales for the Smithsonian Folkways Recordings and Smithsonian Global Sound, and a jazz musician himself. Richard, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you here. So this Smithsonian CD, this is a third in a series, right?
Yeah, well, actually, yes, it's the fourth, in fact. In 1973, the Smithsonian, a guy called Martin Williams, was employed by the Smithsonian to bring jazz into the Smithsonian. And he was a jazz critic, and he put together a set called the Smithsonian Collection of Classic Jazz. And it was kind of a groundbreaking set. In fact, there hadn't been a set like that before. It was five CDs, and it went right up to about 1963, I think it was, which was about 10 years from the time he made it, which was 73. And then it was revamped again in 87 and remastered in 97 and then went out of print because they closed that division of the institution. I started at the Smithsonian in 2001, went to work for Smithsonian Folkways, and the first thing I said was, what about this collection? Can we get that out again? And then I discovered the whole saga and started unraveling it. And, you know, here we are nearly 10 years later.
And why did it take 10 years to unravel and put together?
Well, you know, initially I thought we would just sort of put it out again or just update it a little bit. But then when we started to kind of deconstruct it, we realized that was going to be tough because Martin had ended, as I say, in the early 60s. Then he'd added one track from 1980, the World Saxophone Quartet, but there was nothing in between the early 60s and 80 and nothing after 80. So we realized that we needed to add four decades of music if we wanted to bring it up to date, but we could only really add one CD if we wanted to keep it reasonably priced. So effectively, you know, what we've done is we've doubled the number of artists on the set, which meant we had to really rethink the whole set.
And there's a way this set goes. I mean, I want to just queue up for a minute. Brian, we're going to queue up. Let's queue up disc one, cut one. Just to queue that up and hear that a little bit as we're talking. Because the way this CD goes, you start, it's an interesting way to listen to this thing. You start early.
Right.
Early on. And what we hear in here is Dick Hyman, Maple Leaf Rag, right?
Right, exactly. And interestingly, we didn't use the original recording of Scott Joplin playing it for the reason.
Right.
Yeah. Well, the reason is because it's a piano roll. It was recorded, I think, in 1916. And piano rolls are mechanical. They can be repunched. They don't have the dynamics. Dick Hyman's well known for playing letter perfect versions of Scott Joplin. And this song was written in 1899. So, you know, this kind of gives us like more than 100 years of music on the set, effectively.
Wow.
But this recording was done, I think, in the 70s. It's been a while since I looked. But
you have three renditions of
We do.
Maple Leaf Rag on this.
Yeah, that was the pedagogical moment, the teaching moment, which is, you know, a lot of the thinking behind the set was to make it good for jazz history, jazz appreciation professors and courses. And even high schools. I mean, let's face it, the big band scene is alive and well in high schools. So, you know, it's a great introduction in that regard. But it gives a real good sense of, jazz kind of came out of ragtime, and then you got the Bechet version, and then you have this Anthony Braxton version, which is extremely modern.
So our phones are ringing here. Let me just take a little quick digression.
Sure.
We're not going to pitch now, but I want to tell folks something since I hear the phones ringing. If you're calling 410-319-8888 and want to make a pledge, a pledge of $150 on your credit card spread out across the course of the year gets you the Smithsonian Anthology, this incredible jazz anthology. Let you know now in case you want to call while we're talking. 410-319-8888. But back to the conversation.
Yeah.
Since I heard the phone ring, I had to tell him that.
Please. No. We all have to stay alive.
Exactly.
We do.
So the interesting thing about this, the liner notes, was the idea about how jazz grew.
Right.
About the world of jazz beginning in New Orleans.
Right.
And then and then artists fleeing New Orleans for lots of reasons, which we can talk about,
right,
and spreading themselves out across the nation and across the globe that just made this phenomenon explode.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I Jose Bowen, who was one of the executive selection committee, just made a good point in an article he did recently. You know, people often, some people who like jazz don't really like fusion. But Jose said, you know, jazz has always been fusion, and that's the truth.
Jazz has always been fusion.
It's always been fusion. And when you look at New Orleans, why did jazz happen in New Orleans? Well, we don't really know because it happened, you know, just a little bit before recording. But we can surmise, and clearly there was this amazing melting pot down there, this gumbo, if you like. And so all these different races and cultures and ways of thinking and musics met in New Orleans, and out of it came jazz and quite a few other things, actually.
So is this cut two we're hearing? I think it's cut two.
I think it is. Bunk
Johnson. Bunk's Brass Band.
Yeah, exactly.
And so let's slide over. I really love this piece you're having here. Let's slide over to cut number eight, because it is a classical cut. Bessie Smith.
Yeah.
And James P. Johnson, Blackwater Blues.
Love this trick.
You can't mistake who that is.
You cannot.
I know. I mean, the power of jazz, especially in this early part of jazz, I mean, it was like an amalgam of music that came from the soul of the fields into the city and created this new form of music.
Exactly, yeah. And this is interesting because this is kind of like right around the division point, I guess, between blues and jazz, because you could say Bessie Smith's a blues artist as much, but you know, she played with a lot of people who are definitely jazz. James P. Johnson was, you know, really the grandfather of stride piano and phenomenal musician. Plus, he wrote the Charleston. A lot of people don't know that.
Charleston.
The song, the Charleston.
He wrote the Charleston.
He wrote the song, yeah. And phenomenal musician.
So describe for our listeners who don't know what you just said what stride piano is.
Well, stride piano is, you know, that left-hand vamping thing. You can actually hear it a little bit on this, you know, just moving from jumping the tenth, the octave, in the left hand. So, and there were, it was a big style piano. You can hear it quite a bit on the album. There are quite a few examples of stride. But, so this is really an interesting sort of point. Actually, on the original set, Martin Williams had Robert Johnson on there, who, of course, is, you know, the archetypical blues guy.
Uh-huh.
But we felt, well, blues is its own genre, you know, it divided off pretty early on from jazz.
And speaking of jazz, one of the couple of things I cut on here in this first CD before we move to the second CD that really hit me as jazz, and you can pick some too, brother, because don't leave me alone here, because this is your world, not mine.
Sure.
I'm playing it, you live in it. but if you take, let's say, cut number nine, which is Duke.
Yeah.
Duke Ellington and his orchestra, Black and Tan Fantasy. When did he play this?
I think this was, 1927. Yeah.
1920s.
Duke Ellington's a phenomenon because, you know, he really transcended virtually every period. I mean, he went through every period. And bear in mind, by the way, that, and this is a pertinent point to the whole question of what is jazz. Duke Ellington didn't like his music to be called jazz. He just thought it was jazz. He just thought he wrote music. And actually, John Edward Hasse, who's one of the executive selection committee for the set, he's also the curator of American music at the Smithsonian, and he's a producer on the set. He wrote a definitive book about Ellington called Beyond Category. And, of course, that's really the description of Ellington's music, as it was beyond category. And Ellington himself was beyond category.
I mean, jazz, to me, as many people call it, is America's classical music.
Yeah, I think that's it.
It's our homegrown music.
Yeah.
It belongs to us.
Yeah, absolutely. No question.
It belongs to the black world and us, and it just came out of this world.
Mm-hmm.
But it spawned a lot.
Oh, yeah.
When you think about it. I mean, if you think of most show tunes on Broadway that made all this money and all these great Broadway shows, they come out of jazz, all that kind of...
There's a constant back and forth, I think, all the way along. Because if you think about things like Motown, you know, all those musicians that played on the Motown records were effectively jazz musicians to start with, and that's why the standard of musicianship was so high. And Berry Gordy thought about that. And you think about even Atlantic started out kind of more in that area and then moved more into R&B and so on and so forth. So, you know, Marvin Gaye's early records were kind of jazzy. So I think there's been this constant back and forth. And you see that even with some of these musicians, as I say on the set, like someone like James P. Johnson.
One of the things you're doing here, and let me make a really good piece that maybe comes out of the Prohibition era, because I want to play something and a little riff with you and see if you think I'm wrong or right, and if our listeners out there think I'm wrong or right about this. What's a good piece from the 30s, man?
Oh.
How about Louis Armstrong?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Swing That Music? Does that work?
Oh, I love that, yeah.
Let's do cut 20 on this first CD before we hit the second disc.
Absolutely.
And when you hear this, one of the things you said in the liner notes made me think of this. In the liner notes, you wrote that when the speakeasies happened and Prohibition happened, and they said no more booze, everything opened up, jazz went into the speakeasies.
Yeah.
They became part of the nightlife underground world
of the era.
And I started thinking about all the genres that have come out of the African-American world in terms of music, whether it's jazz or blues, soul even in some levels, hip-hop, that it's all been kind of driven underground at some level.
Usually,
On the fringes of society.
Yeah.
So that the rebelliousness of America found its soul through black music.
Yeah.
I've always kind of thought, when you wrote that in that intro, that's what popped in my head.
Yeah, well, I think you said before about this explosion out of New Orleans that went basically up to Chicago initially and to New York. And actually, a lot of the reason why that happened was because they closed Storyville, which was a red light district in New Orleans, and that put a lot of musicians out of work. So they had to go somewhere else. And obviously, Chicago was hopping because all the factories and were opening up there and so on and so forth. This was the booming time in the Industrial Revolution and car manufacturing and so on and so forth. So, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of the underground element. Also, dance figures very significantly in jazz. When you think about it, swing music, the big bands, the big swing bands, were the pop music of the time in the 30s and 40s. And then when it went to bebop, which I love, people couldn't dance to bebop as well, and jazz became less popular, which is interesting. And the popularity moved to R&B, which you could dance to.
Which you could dance to.
Right.
Exactly. Let's slide into CD 2 here as we continue this conversation before we jump into our break. And I was thinking when you just said that, let's go to cut 2 on disc 2.
Mm-hmm.
Or cut 3, excuse me, brother, cut 3. And that's Lionel Hampton. Is that right? Do I have that right?
Lionel Hampton, yeah.
And When the Lights Are Low.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hear a little bit of that as we go to break here. Now, this is dance music.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, no question about it.
And people hit that floor and dance like they never danced before.
Yeah. Oh, no question. Well, one of my favorite stories in the book is about Chick Webb and his orchestra. And the only band, they played at the Savoy. And they used to have these cutting competitions where they had two stages and they'd have one band come in and try to beat out Chick Webb. And no one could beat Chick Webb except Count Basie. And Count Basie came in. And the thing that was different about Count Basie was he didn't have heavy arrangements. He was a riff-based band.
Uh-huh.
So he could just jam for like 40 choruses. And Chick bands, the Harlem Congo on here is one of my favorite tracks on the album.
On the other disc, you have Count Basie playing One Outlook Jump. 1 o'clock.
Jump. Exactly. Yeah, I'm Basie's obviously unbelievable, but I love that story. That Basie could beat out Chick Webb because he had the freedom. But interestingly, Basie came out of Kansas City, and Kansas City was a pretty underground place, as you put it before.
Yes,
there was a lot of not legal activity going on there that made the nightlife incredible.
We're going to take a short break and come right back, so we don't want you all to go away. We are here with Richard Burgess, producer and project director for Jazz, this Smithsonian anthology, this incredible 6-CD set, The History of Jazz. Doc Manning will be here shortly, I think, by phone. But don't go away. Stay with us.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I'm here with Richard Burgess, who is the producer and project director of Jazz, the Smithsonian Anthology, a six CD set, wonderful history in the liner notes, amazing set about the history, the history of jazz in America. The fourth episode of this in the history of Smithsonian's jazz work. Doc Manning's with us as well, host of On In the Tradition, 8 o'clock every Monday night here on WEAA. And as I said by Doc all the time, he's forgotten more about jazz than most of us know. it's true, man.
Mark.
I'm going to say too, Mark. One thing to note for the listeners is there's 111 tracks on six CDs, nearly 8 hours of music, and a 200-page book. And I think the other thing I'm very proud of with the set is the team, because we had some of the greatest jazz experts in the world working on this. We had this executive selection committee of Dan Morgenstern, David Baker, John Edward Hassey, Jose Bowen, Alan Shipton. They've written hundreds of books between them on jazz. And so, you know, this was not a solo effort by any means. And it really was an incredible team. 35 notes writers, people who we hand-picked because of their expertise in that particular era or that particular artist.
That's amazing. 200-page book.
200-page book, 111 tracks, nearly 8 hours.
Eight hours of listening.
Yeah.
So let me jump to one of these other cuts. We have this two in there, man. Let's just cut to nothing on this two here. Let's look at, I don't know, there's so many things to look at. I know, let's cut quickly to 14. I'm going to talk about this person I've never heard of before. And maybe you have, Doc, and I clearly Richard has, because he has her in the anthology. I thought it was a singer when I first just queued it up to want to hear what she sounded like. But she's a pianist.
She's phenomenal.
Mary Lou Williams.
Yep.
Right.
You've heard it? You know about her, Doc?
Yes, Mary Lou, yeah. Yeah.
She was very influential over a lot of different eras. You know, she kind of not only understood different eras of music, but she could play it. And she used to have these loft parties in New York City. I think she lived on Riverside. And all the musicians, she basically mentored a lot of the young musicians. Phenomenal woman. And one of our objectives in putting out the set was to have greater diversity. We wanted to have more Latin music, more international, and more women. And Mary Lou's a natural. I mean, she's just incredibly influential.
Doc, what do you want to say about Mary Lou?
Yeah, well, Mary Lou was instrumental and Monk used to go over her house. You know, she had an open house, I think.
That's right.
Bert would agree with that.
Yeah.
And Monk would go over there and hang out and play. So one time, Mary Lou came in and scared Monk, and Monk ran into the closet and hid. And, you know, and then looked out. It was he didn't realize who it was, you know. So, and she mentored a lot of people. She wrote and arranged for a lot of people too.
She did.
And she did. She mentored a one who passed away down in New Orleans, Hilton Ruiz, a great pianist, classically trained as well as jazz oriented. And Latin, she mentored him as well. So it shows you that she goes from one era all the way up to the present. I mean, she was there. She was instrumental in a lot of those things. And which explodes the myth that said that women didn't do it much for the forward motion of that music. You know what I mean? So,
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you had Lil Hardin, who was Louis Armstrong's wife, but she played with Louis Armstrong before they got married. So the women made a great contribution to jazz.
So where we should just, since you can't see this thing, Doc, we're gonna hit. You can't see the book we're looking at. I might have to give you one of these as a present, Doc.
Yeah,
I'm gonna have to give you one of these as a present.
Will you know what I have? I don't have an updated version because I have the second edition, I believe. Okay.
Yeah, we gotta get you the updated version.
Yeah, because I had all the LPs and people would always try to borrow them from me. You know what I mean? but what you guys are doing and talking about this means a lot because I don't think anyone had that much.
Thanks for calling WEA. Hello.
I don't think too many people had that much of a discussion about it, and only you could hear on these airways, which is significant, I think. And all the work you guys did for that, you know, and also, Mr. Burgess, all the work you've done to chronicle all this. And it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. I looked at, I go back and I refer to that a lot when I need to get through something. You know what I mean? I want to get through the eras and I want to know about the history and I want to make sure I have it down pat. So if I had to do a presentation, that's what I go to.
And that was a big part of our objective here. It took 7 years. I mean, actually, I started working on it almost 10 years ago, but 7 years ago I sent out the first emails to the advisory panel. We had a 42-person advisory panel, and then we put together the 5-person executive selection committee. So really a lot of time. I didn't think it would take that long, but actually it's a deep subject, you know, and you start digging and more stuff comes out. So it really did take that long to organize everything and get everything the way we wanted it.
Let's take a jump into another cut on this that will take us to a very different place, because as we talked about earlier, jazz kind of took hold of the world. We're going to go to cut 22, man. Cut 22 on this too. We're going to go there because I think that it speaks to how jazz has become this multicultural phenomenon, how the Afro-Latino world and Latino world was touched by it, and it touched jazz. And we're listening now to Machito and his African-Cuban orchestra. This is Tanga. And so this is what, back in the 40s?
Yeah, and that's when we sort of went into what they now call Latin jazz, and some people call it Afro-Cuban jazz. Basically, it's the Cuban influence. But interestingly, you go back as far as Jelly Roll Morton, and really the earliest jazz out of New Orleans. I think Jelly Roll Morton said all jazz needs to have a little Spanish tinge. And
right.
I think there's a lot of truth in that, you know, that Caribbean, Latin, Spanish influence.
Well, as my Cuban friends would say, that Cuba is nothing but another African nation.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
So give us a little riff on this, on Machito, Doc.
Machito, what's so significant about him is just the fact that he had all these dynamics going on, but it shows you also where when Virgil was mentioning that the music was popular initially in terms of dance music. And then it went to more of a cerebral thing, if we call it a so-called art form. And what was happening was that you noticed that the music, the dance, was put in the mind of our existence. You know what I mean? And therefore you had the more of the cerebral approach. But when the Afro-Cuban approach came, what Machito did, when they came in, they brought more of the dance back into it with that fervor. You know, and that's what I heard. That's what I was hearing. You know. I said, this is really interesting. And you had bebop tones and all this other stuff. All these things were happening, and all these streams of culture were crossing each other. And you had it right in the music, was right there. You didn't have to go anywhere, you know?
Yeah. That's exactly right. That's what's so exciting about it.
So yeah. I think we have to take a short break here, and we're going to come right back with our guest and the CD and talk about the history of jazz in America. So stay with us. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'm here in the studio with Richard Burgess, who's producer and project director of Jazz, the Smithsonian Anthology. He's also their director of marketing and sales at Smithsonian Folkways Recordings and Smithsonian Global Sound. Doc Manning is with us. He's host of In the Tradition. You can hear every Monday night at 8 o'clock right here on WEAA. He is just one of our jazz geniuses. 410-309-8888. So let's go to Disc 3. You got Disc 3 queued up, bro? So, and let me jump to something. Just because I think that we can pick a number of these. I want you to have me pick some of these, Richard. But let's go first to cut 7, just because I'm going to be selfish.
Love it.
One of the groups that introduced me to jazz as a young boy of 14 was the Modern Jazz Quartet.
Ah.
And this is Django.
Yeah, third stream. It's when they've combined, again, fusion, combining classical music with jazz. And what's interesting about this track is it's when Kenny Clarke was playing drums. Of course, Kenny Clarke was one of the archetypal or the architects of bebop. He was one of the two drummers, Max Roach and Kenny Clarke. They're associated with beginnings of bebop. Phenomenal track.
Doc?
That's Klook. He's mentioning Klook.
That's right.
Richard, I'm just trying to figure out how you've been feeling in terms of all this research and you're getting this down and you're articulating all this. It's a tough job, but it seems like you've done a lot of good work with it, and you expanded it, you revamped it, and the new additions to it. I think that's really interesting, too.
Well, and depending on the fact that you know everything I've forgotten, by the way, Doc, as well as everything you...
But that music, I mean, it just speaks so much to so many different places, and I'm sitting here in the car. By the way, I got air conditioner on, but it's funny.
We don't.
I know. Believe me, I do know. That music, I mean, it has so much to offer, you know. And that's the reason why we chronicle all this, you know, because we have to get people to listen to it a little more and figure out where it comes from. And all of a sudden, you wind up looking at yourself. You said, this is all us. Nobody's left out. Everybody's in there.
Yeah, I mean, we want people to discuss this. We want people to debate this. You know, there are tons of other ways we could have done this set. You know, there are other people we could have put in. Basically, we were trying to give people this kind of panoramic overview, is how I describe it in my notes. And I think we achieved that. You know, of course, we left people out. If somebody wants to, debate that, we love that. Because this is America's great art form. I mean, America's made a lot of great contributions. As you can probably tell, I wasn't born here. I came to America because of jazz. I came to America to study with Alan Dawson, who taught Tony Williams, who was a drummer with Miles Davis.
I went
to Berklee College of Music, you know. And that's the power of this music. It's so powerful.
So do me a favor here, if you would, Richard. Look at this three. I could pick them all out because I've listened to this thing so much now. But pick out something that speaks to you about what we need to jump to in jazz, just in terms of switching the conversation a bit and what you feel that speaks to kind of a different interpretation of what we all often hear.
Well, I think I love the Sonny Rollins St. Thomas. I mean, that's beautiful.
Cut 12.
Because it's
Cut 12.
A great interpretation of basically a folk tune. He took a Caribbean folk tune that he'd heard as a child and wrote St. Thomas, which is a modification. But this is the great Max Roach playing drums, and it's an amazing, I think it's 32-bar solo, where he effectively plays the tune on the drums and everybody comes right back in.
Let's listen to this for a minute, and then we'll riff on it. Okay, I didn't know, man. I didn't know the mic was on, but it is. That's good. So, Richard Burgess, Doc Manning. Looking at listening to this piece here. I mean, I think that we don't realize the many forms that jazz takes.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, it morphs when it morphs with different popular sounds of different decades and musical moments. It changes when it's touched by another culture.
Absolutely.
It changes when some jazz greats on this kind of make a twist to it that nobody had thought of. When Thelonious made his twist, or Coltrane made his twist, or Miles made his many twists.
Yeah. I've said before, it's kind of like a metaphor for America, you know, the freedom. And I think that's why it's been so powerful. We probably spent, I'm not exaggerating, we probably spent 2 months trying to define jazz when we were writing the notes. We went round and round, and every time you sort of come up with something, you go, well, it's not that. You know, you go, it's syncopation. Well, Latin music has syncopation. You know, ragtime has syncopation. And then you go, well, it's swing. Well, maybe it's swing, but then what about all the jazz that doesn't swing, per se? And you know, it's improvisation. Well, Bach had improvisation. You know, so,
That's right.
It's really interesting. It's kind of intangible, and that's a beautiful thing about it. It's sort of like this... the American spirit that infuses it. But there's a certain freedom to it, and there's a certain kind of sense of development, I think. And you know it when you hear it.
Yeah.
You know it when you hear it.
It's just, yeah, you do. It's such a like it, well, Duke said, it's nothing better than a cymbal swinging in celebration. I think I heard someone say that once, you know.
Yeah.
When you sit down, you think about the freedom of Max Roach and how he brought more melody to the music as well. Everybody had their part to play, and they just brought it, you know, unrestricted, you know. They brought their personalities into it. And I think it's like what Richard is saying, that these personalities, their feelings of expression, make the music, you know. That's what it comes down to. And where there's no other place that it developed here out of this idea of freedom, this idea of democracy, as Duke Ellington would say, you know. It took place here, you know. And then it's pervasive throughout the world, you know.
I think you're exactly right, Doc. I mean, that it's that sense of individualism, that sense of freedom that you can express yourself. And the one thing that we always say about a great jazz musician is that he has a unique voice, or she has a unique voice. You can identify the greats within two bars, you know, or one bar sometimes.
Yeah, you're right. That's what gets you, you know what I mean? You hear Train or you hear, of course, like you mentioned, Count Basie, that groove he would put on.
Yeah.
He was so blues oriented. I mean, he had it all there, and he would drive the band, and he would play one or two notes, and meant more than those 30 someone else would play. You know what I mean?
So, exactly. And by the way, with respect to the freedom aspect you brought up, one of the things I love about the set, and this, I didn't necessarily have control over this because I kind of, you know, put everybody together and said, okay, you know, what are we going to do here? And it starts with Scott Joplin, who was the son of a slave, wrote Maple Leaf Rag in 1899.
Yeah.
It ends with Tomasz Stanko, who's a Polish trumpeter, who learned his jazz from Voice of America broadcasts and from black market cassette tape, poor copies of cassette tapes of jazz that came through the Iron Curtain. And I think right there, it tells you a lot about this music, the power of this music. And actually, a lot of dictatorships around the world have been terrified of jazz because of that. Because of that freedom, you know.
It's funny that you mentioned Tomasz Stanko. You know, he's Warsaw, Poland, and he has I think he's back and forth in New York, and he has a place in New York.
Yep.
And what's so interesting about him, we talk a lot because he comes and plays in the area sometimes, you know, in the Baltimore, you know. And we were talking about the same thing. He mentioned that. And we had the same birthday, 7-Eleven.
Wow.
7-Eleven.
I like that, 7-Eleven.
You mentioned him, and he has a beautiful sound, you know. He understands where it comes from. He knows where it's going. And he has that knack of getting other people together to play this music, and he keeps reinventing himself in terms of the youthfulness of the music. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're going to take a very brief break and come right back. A very quick break. You hear this now? The Oscar Peterson under us right now, Old Man River, and which is on this incredible CD. We're going to pick up a really amazing pieces to share with you. Maybe a little Charlie Mingus. Maybe we'll jump into some Chick Corea. Maybe we'll get into Herbie Hancock, Weather Report, Keith Jarrett is on here, Art Ensemble of Chicago, and more. Stay with us. We're right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here with Richard Burgess, who is the producer and project director for Jazz and the Smithsonian Anthology. He's also director of marketing and sales at the Smithsonian Folkways Recording and Smithsonian Folkways Recordings and Smithsonian Global Sound. Doc Manning is host of In the Tradition here at WEAA every Monday night at 8 p.m. What is that under us?
Count Basie, isn't it?
That's Count Basie, I think.
Yeah. I was going to ask you that.
Yeah.
That's the young...
Yeah, and interesting, it's Buddy Rich playing drums, because I think he showed up at the session and said to the drummer, "Why don't you just take a day off? I'll do the session."
let's slide in disc number five, and you were suggesting that we take a little couple of shifts to the modern, to the more recent era, we're going to hear a little Stan Getz and Astrid Gilberto, the girl from Ipanema, is coming up next. Disc five, cut two. So as we get ready to hear this, I mean, this is again kind of taking jazz into this part of the world.
Right. Well, Brazil. Yeah. But Getz, of course, was a great. I mean, I'm sure you can riff on Getz forever, right, Doc?
Yeah. You know, he is the person who comes out of Lester Young.
Exactly. Yeah.
Big sound and full sound out of New York, and he's one of the persons he's worked with would be Charlie Byrd down in Washington D.C.
Yep.
And he got together, and they came up with this whole phenomenon with Bossa Nova with Louis Bonfa and also the other gentleman, I can't forget it, remember his name. And they brought this to us, and it was very romantic, subtle in certain parts, but very strong. I had an opportunity to see him at Left Bank Jazz Society at 1717 North Charles.
Wow, I remember that, too.
Yeah. Had a nice talk with him, you know what I mean? During that period, he could talk to you. You know, sometimes he had rough edges, but this time he was really great with Joanne Burkeen and Billy Hart. You know, and I never forgot that because he took the time, you know, to talk to me. You know, and that big sound of his, man, you hear it; it's flowing. Man. It's just undeniable. You know, beautiful, weighty, and so articulate. I mean, just sounds so great. And he had that even to the end of his life. He was doing that with Abby Lincoln and a lot of other people. He was doing a lot of different stuff. Stan Getz, who was a pivotal figure in the music. Yeah.
And Astrid Gilberto, of course, was a housewife, and she just happened to be at the session. That is a great story. You want to tell that story, Doc?
Yeah. You remember when she got to that mode of singing, she was reluctant to do that, you know
yeah.
what I mean? But at the same time, everybody wanted to sing like her. The whole world wanted to sing like her after she did that.
Yeah, you know? No question about it.
Yeah.
And as we're talking about this, let's slide on over to Cut 12 when we have time here. A little Herbie Hancock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Talking about another kind of of the 60s and 70s.
Well, this is the fusion, the funk. This is bringing the funk element in.
Yeah.
And that's actually from the Mbuti Pygmies, this introduction.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that sound is.
Yeah.
You're right.
Hindahoo.
The Mbutes, where they are trying to decimate and kill as we speak.
Yeah.
It's not a good thing. That's another show. We did that show the other week. So, you know, when you look at this jazz set, the CD that you put together, and think about where jazz is going, the both of you, but starting with you, Richard, I mean.
Yeah.
Because as you end the CD with stuff that how Europeans have been affected by the sound of jazz. Now they've become and created their own sounds. You have Thomas Tanco at the end and Masada before that, which is some people were controversial because it came out of klezmer world, Jewish
right.
music. But the jazz is like encompassed the sense of freedom around the planet, and people are kind of changing it as they go.
And that's what I love about it. I think, you know, the truth is we don't know where it's going. And I think almost certainly it'll go somewhere where we can't predict. And that's what's beautiful about it. Some kid will come along, he's got a different set of influences, a different set of interests, and somehow take the fundamental core values of jazz, which is effectively a sense of freedom, and make some music that just blows us away.
Now, folks, we have to take a break here. And I just want to encourage everybody as we go to break, 410-319-8888 is the number to call. Show your support for WEAA. Make that pledge of $150 and make it now. If you do that pledge now, we will send you this 200-page book, 8 hours of incredible music, jazz, the Smithsonian Anthology. 410-319-8888. Make sure you support now. This is your public radio station. I want to thank Richard Burgess for coming all the way up from D.C. to do this today. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
Producer and project director for Jazz, the Smithsonian Anthology, and our own Doc Manning, host of In the Tradition. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Richard, we got to get together.
Definitely, Doc. Let's do
okay.
that.
All right, Richard.
All right.
Take care, Richard, and Doc, we'll get together soon.
Thanks.
All right, thank you very much.